Mallory, and I'm just sitting in Pilsen waiting for a Tinder date. But you're listening to Outside the Loop Radio, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Oh, man. Thanks, Mal. You're still waiting for that Tinder date. Woof. All right. Well, good luck. And welcome to Outside the Loop. This is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. Great to be here with you today. This is show number 851. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer in the WGN radio studio today. So good morning to Fergie. I hope everyone is staying warm out there, staying safe. And speaking of Tinder, boy, that app and our cell phones have really changed the game here. And I remember I was having this conversation with someone recently back when cell phones, I mean, they were still on the scene, but they were more, I guess, kind of like the flip phones. And certainly before that, when you got someone's number, shall we say, that was a pretty big deal, right? Like if you are interested in someone and, hey, let me get your number. And that was like a big thing. Certainly when you're in high school, back when I was in high school in the 90s, and you got someone's number, you had to call their house. And if their parents answered, which was always a little terrifying for me, but when the parents answered, you know, you would have to ask for that person and go through the whole thing. But now when people get someone's number, it's, okay, cool. Yeah, I'll just shoot you a text. Not a big deal. And I think some of the magic is taken out of that, because now this generation and generations subsequent won't know that fear, right? The trembling of, okay, I've got to call this person that I'm really into. But what if her dad answers? Oh boy, what's he going to say? Now you can just go straight to the person of interest here, right? Laura Washington in the Chicago Tribune also wrote a piece that's kind of related to this. It's titled, "The Digital Age is Destroying the Art of the Letter." And this was in the Trib. And she says that the fact that we have everything done digitally here is taking away the magic of writing a letter to someone. She says here in her column, "I am a professional scribe. I love to write, but I can't recall the last time I hand wrote or received a real letter. The digital age is destroying the art of the letter. Our missives are conveyed through emails, tweets, texts, posts, and videos. If we can't do it on our laptops or cell phones, we don't do it. We have forgotten the touch of paper, the dabs of ink that carry our love, joy, rage, and intellect from finger to page." She goes on to say that there's been a year-on-year decline in mail volume, according to the U.S. Postal Service, and it's getting lower each year. So we're not sending each other letters either. So, look, I embrace technology. I'm not some Luddite here, but again, thinking about the last time I got a handwritten note. Actually, I do know when I got a handwritten letter from my nephew, Jack, who is 11. He sent me a thank you note. He sent my wife and I and my kids a thank you note for, I think it was Christmas gifts. And he wrote a darn good letter. So good for you, Jack Carter. And oh, and his sister, Lily, too. She writes a very good thank you note. So let's write someone a letter. Carry that tradition on, you know? Also, are we even teaching cursive in schools anymore? Okay, that's a topic for another show. Go ahead, write that letter. Let's talk some local education. According to preliminary data released by the Illinois State Board of Education, there is an overall decline in enrollment when it comes to the state's student population. In addition to this, the number of students learning English as a second language is growing. Samantha Smiley is the state education reporter for Chalkbeat Chicago, and she wrote the story about these topics and some others as well. And she is with us here today on Outside the Loop. Samantha, welcome back to the show.
Hey.
Great to talk to you again. And so we can go to chicago.chalkbeat.org if we want to read what you are writing, of course. So let's start off by talking about this. So overall, enrollment in the state, student enrollment, dropped by about 31,000 students. That's 1.7% since last school year. 9,000 students are from CPS. Tell us about this. Is this a cause for worry? Are people sort of freaking out? Or what does this mean? Give us some context here.
Yeah, no problem. So the State Board of Education released these numbers during its monthly board meeting. And the way that it was described to us and the public and media was that, like, even though this is a decline, and I don't think anybody would say a decline is good, it's just that this decline looks similar to what it was pre-pandemic years. When like the pandemic hit, during the 2020 and 21 school year, there was a 3.5% drop, which looked like 69,000 students left public schools around the state. So yeah, while this isn't a, you know, a great thing that decline is still happening, it is a lot less than it was when the pandemic really hit schools. But there's still some questions about why are students leaving still.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that in terms of why this is happening. I know that Illinois has gone through some population shifts over the years, but still, to try to figure this out, why the numbers are going down, are there any guesses here? Anyone making a hypothesis?
Yeah, I mean, like, some people would agree that it's probably part of it is because of the population changes that we're seeing across the state. I'm pretty sure some people would just say, like, families are opting out of public schools. However, Illinois doesn't really track where students go once they leave public schools. Mm-hmm. And also, like, you know, just to bring this out a little bit, like, the state is collecting data for 852 school districts. And this, you know, this rate isn't, like, constantly, like, updated in real time. And so it's always better to look at local school districts to kind of see what's going on, because the state data can only give us a real glance at what's happening.
So in terms of why this is happening, jury's still out. We're still trying to figure this out. And I know that the state is going to release the school report card. I think that's in the fall of this year. And that's more of a complete picture with more context and more data. But that, again, I believe that's coming out in October of this year.
Yes, that's correct. And that data will have way more than what was released this month. Like, this month, we just got, like, the overall, like, early numbers, like, very early numbers. And then we just got some data points about English learners and, I believe, students who come from low-income families. But we should have more specific data on, like, grade level, other student groups, and maybe even we'll probably know, like, you know, where the changes are coming from in different school districts, because the report could also give us more, like, local numbers. And all of that is super important for us to create, like, a better picture of what's happening, like, when it comes to why students are leaving our public schools.
So in terms of why the state even releases preliminary data, is that fairly standard? Is that just to give us a heads up? Is that to say, hey, here's what we're seeing, or here's a trend, more to come?
Yeah, I think that because we're still dealing with the pandemic, but we're not dealing with the early days and the crisis that the pandemic caused. And so I think the idea behind releasing the numbers right now is kind of giving people a picture of, like, how this school year is going. And I have seen them do this, like, maybe once or twice during the pandemic, because, you know, other states are also reporting some early numbers as well. So it kind of makes sense.
So I want to come back to this. The number of English language learners continues to grow in Illinois, a 4% jump, according to the preliminary data that was released by the Illinois State Board of Education. Tell us the significance of this.
This is also a piece where it's like, this is really good news to see that more English learners are coming into our public schools and hopefully getting the services that they need. But we kind of need to look at like at least the last 5 or 6 years to see if there was like a drop in like early grades during the pandemic, like preschool, kindergarten, maybe first, second, third grade, and see if like when those numbers dip this school year, did they increase? And maybe if that's the reason why we're seeing such an increase in these numbers. But it's so hard to tell exactly like how did, you know, the state get this increase in numbers.
Another issue here that we have to think about is, okay, we've got this 4% jump, and I believe that works out to over 200,000 or so students across the state of Illinois that are English language learners. So that means we have to have teachers who are qualified to teach these students, and not every teacher is officially endorsed to do that. So that is, I know, another topic that people are concerned about, that, okay, we've got this increase. We have to make sure that we have enough teachers that are equipped to teach these students.
Yeah, and that's not to make this like a general statement, but yes, the state is still dealing with a teacher crisis, teacher shortage crisis. There are a lot more vacancies now, and the vacancies, we've seen them in bilingual educators and special education teachers. And, you know, the state is working to boost those numbers by creating a grant to, you know, help teachers get like a bilingual endorsement. You know, the state has also increased the Minority Teacher Illinois Scholarship to like $4.2 million. And then there's just a lot of work in also getting teachers of color through educator prep programs and then into the classroom.
And the work continues with that. I know that is an ongoing issue that the state is facing, and other states across the United States as well. I want to, before I let you go here, Samantha, I want to touch on this. The outgoing superintendent proposed a budget for the Illinois public school system. This is looking at here a $516 million increase, 5.3% to the state's education budget. And this is in the process of getting approved. There was some controversy, as you report, about the budget, or concern, I suppose. The education advocates across the state say that this isn't enough. They would like to see more. Well, what's the latest with the budget here?
Yeah, so, you know, state agencies usually put out a budget proposal or recommendation around this time. So we have one from the Illinois State Board of Education. Then there was another from the Illinois Board of Higher Education. So the Illinois State Board of Education proposed a $350 million increase to the evidence-based funding formula for that supports K-12 schools. They also asked for a 10% increase in the early childhood education block grant that they see that they have to support pre-K programs. Now, this is just a proposal. It goes to the governor, who's also making a budget proposal himself that we'll hear about February 15th, I believe. And he will say like what his, you know, budget priorities are. And during the spring legislative session, the General Assembly will come together and, you know, put together a budget, sign it off, send it to the governor for him to enforce. So, you know, that it's like a whole process.
Yeah.
But yes, and this is what the board recommended, but advocates are like, we need way more money. Some have suggested a $550 million increase because that seems more doable. Some people are saying it should be over $900 million for the evidence-based funding formula. And then a lot of early childhood advocates are asking for a 20% increase in early childhood education, because when it comes to early childhood education, it's just that the state hasn't put significant increases into that budget line in a while. And so like, yes, K-12 has a lot of budget issues, but early ed has some severe budget issues, and it really impacts like the people who serve our youngest students. Like most times I hear stories of the fact that those providers have to work a second or third job to make ends meet. And also because of that, there's not enough people going to early ed, which impacts our students. So
that budget process is still happening. The discussion is still happening, and we'll see where all that goes. But this is the latest when we think about education issues. Of course, there are many more issues, and we can go to chicago.chalkbeat.org if we would like to read the coverage of Chalkbeat, really providing us, I think, with a very important service covering local education. And Samantha Smiley is the state education reporter for Chalkbeat Chicago. Samantha, thank you as always for talking to us and for all of your great reporting. These are very, very important issues, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on today.
February is Black History Month, and I thought it might be interesting to take a look back on a segment that I did about a year ago, March of 2022, here on this show. I talked with Kate Mazur, who is a professor of history at Northwestern University, and she's also instrumental in the project called Black Organizing and Pre-Civil War Illinois. This is an online exhibit that gives us a view of history that maybe many of us didn't know, specifically as it pertains to Black history. So right now, let's rewind back to March of last year, where I start the conversation asking Kate to explain what this project is all about.
What we did at Northwestern, with help from advisors elsewhere, was we created a web exhibit on the history of African Americans in Illinois in, as you said, the pre-Civil War years, going a little bit into the Civil War. Our web exhibit is part of a larger project called the Colored Conventions Project, which is based at Penn State. That project, which is directed by a professor named Gabrielle Foreman, has existed for quite a while and is collecting and archiving online in a freely accessible way documents associated with Black political organizing in the 19th century across the country, North and South, pre-Civil War and post-Civil War. And they offer the opportunity for people not at Penn State to become teaching partners with them, and through teaching and other kinds of collaborative work, to design exhibits associated with certain themes or topics that they deal with in their larger website. So that's kind of where we connected with what they're doing.
Yeah, and it's really, again, this what you've put together here and the larger Colored Conventions Project, I think, is really important because it offers part of history that maybe many of us don't know, or we never learned, you know, growing up in school. And so with that in mind, and we'll get into some of the details about this exhibit, but how did you and your team go about researching this? What was that process like?
It was really interesting because we also began this work essentially like right when the pandemic started. And so I had plans when I was teaching a class associated with it starting in March of 2020. We were going to go down to the Chicago History Museum and look at old newspapers and the other kinds of sources that they have there. And all that got scrapped. So we actually did most of the research here online. And that's kind of an interesting facet of this. There's so many digitized sources at this point. We also used online resources that Northwestern subscribes to. So for example, Northwestern has a subscription to Ancestry.com, which we used a lot, especially for census research. Northwestern has subscriptions to lots of digitized newspapers. There's also the freely available Illinois digital newspaper collection out of University of Illinois, where there's no paywall. So, and there's digitized county histories. And so we actually were able to, using strategies that I kind of already knew about from doing my own historical research, we were able to do a lot of online research, a surprising amount. And we kind of had to because of the pandemic, too.
Well, you know, talking about this exhibit here, and again, you're looking at Illinois and Chicago, and the exhibit is called Black Organizing in Pre-Civil War Illinois, Creating Community, Demanding Justice. You know, there's this narrative, this sort of traditional narrative of history that says here, you know, Illinois in the north, this was kind of a great opportunity for black folks. And certainly black people are moving here. You know, here we are. We're the land of Lincoln. Right. But there are examples of anti-black policies in the state of Illinois, and going through this site, and we will link up to it on our all of our social channels and web pages. I mean, you just get a sense of what we didn't learn in school, that in Illinois, here in the North, where there was no slavery, we still had plenty of discrimination that was codified in law.
It's really true. And I do want people to be more aware of this. The story of the North is a lot more complicated than you might think. And, you know, actually, from the beginning of Illinois as a state, there were white people in Illinois who actually wanted to legalize slavery itself here. And slavery actually already existed here. Now, the pro-slavery faction kind of lost out in those debates in the 1820s, but still the state legislature repeatedly and over decades passed and repassed laws that were designed to discourage African Americans from migrating into the state. And then when they got here, to make their lives very difficult. They had to register their presence with local officials. They had to prove their freedom, prove that they were not runaway slaves. They were not permitted to testify in court cases involving white people. Black men were not permitted to vote. And in 1853, the state legislature went so far as to try to completely bar any future black migration into the state. So these were the kind of policies that were going on, you know, coming out of Springfield, widely supported by politicians. And it was these policies that African Americans and some white allies were, in the course of particularly the 1840s and 50s and into the 60s, trying to get repealed, repeatedly fighting back against those policies.
Yeah, I think that story of resistance is really important. And again, it's something that we might not learn about coming up in school, but there was a considerable amount of resistance to these anti-black policies that were going through the state legislature and were being accepted in Illinois. Can you tell us a little bit about that resistance and what that looked like?
There are a lot of aspects to it. I mean, one question that I always think is interesting to ask is, if you were an African-American person in Illinois in this period, first of all, the black population was 1%, less than 1% of the total population. Mm-hmm. And black men couldn't vote, were not permitted to vote. And so how do you actually get policies changed, especially when most white people don't care about your issues or don't, you know, want to change the policy? So one thing that a lot of that people do is they petition the state legislature. Anyone was permitted to petition. And so they would send petitions explaining why they thought these laws were morally wrong, why they were so damaging to African Americans. And by the way, I mean, these laws also, besides just the kind of the question of enforcing the law as written, these laws really cast African Americans as an outsider class. And they helped white people feel empowered to be really awful, to deprive people of their property, to try to run them out of town from time to time. And so, you know, the laws themselves kind of promoted anti-black feeling. So anyway, there was petitioning. In our website, we talk about the first black statewide political meeting, which happened in 1853 in response to that particularly oppressive law, where the people who attend the meeting then decide to form an Illinois state council to organize throughout the state to get the laws repealed. There are white people who are on their side, particularly concentrated in Chicago by the 1840s and 50s, and a white editor by the name of Zabina Eastman, who was publishing a newspaper, The Western Citizen, that was really against the black laws and really published a lot of articles about the harms that those laws did, and tried to get people as well to petition to support political candidates who would repeal them. The laws were only repealed in 1865. Shortly after the 13th Amendment passed the House of Representatives. So slavery was abolished at the national scale. The Civil War was almost over. And finally, Illinois repealed those laws.
And again, that's something that we just don't usually learn about in history class in school. But you mentioned Chicago before. Let's kind of focus in on Chicago. There's a section in your project that is called Making Black Chicago. So give us a sense of, you know, pre-Civil War here. What was black life in Chicago looking like at that time?
Well, the population of Chicago was growing really rapidly in the 1840s and 50s. This was really the beginning of Chicago as a major city. And the African-American population was still pretty small, most of the Black people in Illinois in this period who were adults anyway were migrants from other places. And most of the time they were migrants from slave states. So a lot of people who ended up in Chicago had been born in places like Kentucky, Missouri, Virginia, as far as way as North Carolina. There were business opportunities for African Americans in Chicago. And Henry Wagner, he and his wife owned a granary, a place where they process grain, and a produce store, and eventually a catering business. Another well-known Black Chicagoan, John Jones, he was a tailor. He was a skilled craftsman, a tailor, who did really well economically in Chicago, ended up investing in real estate, and became very wealthy after the Civil War. So there were a lot of economic opportunities for African Americans, and there was a friendlier than in most places in Illinois white community, a kind of white abolitionist community, who were willing to go out on a limb to oppose these Black laws. After the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act passed, there were Black people were, of course, very opposed to the law and trying to figure out how they could protect one another from being kidnapped and dragged back into slavery. And a lot of white people also stood up at that point and said, we too refuse to cooperate with this law. They kind of made Chicago like a sanctuary city for a while in the 1850s, where they refused to enforce what they considered to be an unjust federal law. So Chicago became, in terms of the rest of Illinois, Chicago became a very special place and a safer place for African Americans.
You even have a map of Chicago and some underground railroad stops, and you've got the map and you've got sort of the dots that indicate where in Chicago were these sort of, again, sanctuaries, right, for these runaway slaves. And, you know, the Underground Railroad, part of that story is through Illinois, through Chicago.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I want to, you know, give credit to Matt Taylor, who was our tech kind of guy, the mapping guy for the site, and Hope McCaffrey, who was a grad student who worked on the site, for creating that really cool map with some Underground Railroad stops. One of the things that we did in the exhibit, we really tried to highlight the roles of women and to write profiles of women to the extent that we could, knowing full well that it's much easier to write, to find information about men than women in history. And one of the things we talked about was how women were integral to the Underground Railroad, because the people who were escaping from slavery, they stayed in the homes of people on the Underground Railroad, right? And so you had to have someone in the home, a woman. We have a profile of a woman named Anna Hudlin, who was known to be someone who welcomed runaways from slavery into her home, who took care of them, who took great risks, right, to have people in her home before they moved on, either by boat or by rail across Lake Michigan and over toward Canada. So Underground Railroad kind of gives us an opportunity to talk about the domestic aspects of the Underground Railroad and the involvement of women in some of these activities.
And very appropriate. Here we are in Women's History Month in March. I mean, this is, and that's something that stuck out at, to me when I was going through the site, is that there is the story of women, which, again, we don't often tell that story, but I think it's really important to highlight that, and how, as you say, how integral the story of women are to this part of our American history. And, you know, Kate, something that was, I think, is confusing for folks, and I've seen it in the classroom for students as well, is, you know, when we tend to think of things in absolutes. So the North, you know, free; the South, slave. But then we start to say, okay, in the North, yes, we didn't have slavery, but we had a lot of discrimination, and there were laws passed that limited freedoms for Black people. And that, I think, is kind of disjointing for some of us, because that kind of knocks out, again, that traditional narrative of, wait a minute, but you're telling me that there was economic opportunity for Black folks in Illinois, but then you're saying that there were laws that prohibited Black folks from coming in. And I think that sometimes we have a difficult time reconciling that. Is that something that you see when we tell the story of American history as well?
It's a really great point. And, you know, part of what it comes to mind is, first of all, it is, I think, and, you know, I teach college, and I have two kids, the younger of which is in high school now. You know, first of all, it takes a while to develop the ability as a kid and a teenager to see nuance, right? So our first, you know, thing is, you know, bad or good? Is this person a bad person or a good person? And it takes a while to kind of see the gray areas. But if we look around in our present day, we can identify all kinds of gray areas, right? And so this is a way of thinking back on the past. So for example, when we talk about, you know, racism or racial inequality today, we can say, well, you know, both for African Americans today, there are opportunities for success, for upward mobility, to become leaders and, you know, you name it, part of life. And yet at the same time, there are still structural obstacles. There is a huge inequality in wealth. There are huge inequalities in healthcare outcomes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are also things that affect people's lives, you know, constantly, right? So on the one hand, you know, you have, imagine somebody like Barack Obama. On the other hand, you have people who are extra susceptible to COVID, who are doing not very well, who don't have opportunities to have good jobs or to, you know, have access to healthy food and what have you in their neighborhoods. And so, you know, just like now, the world that we inhabit is quite complicated. So was it back then, right? And people are complicated. The world was complicated. And part of the trick in history, I think, is navigating that complexity versus generalization, right? So we don't want to say, well, it's all so complicated, nothing can really be said, right? At a certain point, you also have to say, well, all right, what was the general, how would you make a generalization about this situation? And I think that's maybe where the, that's where it gets interesting, right? Like, yeah. Okay, so there are some exceptions. Well, how common are they, right? So I think this is part of what we do as history teachers, especially when we have the opportunity to teach with primary sources and to get really deep into the material.
You know, I think one of the takeaways for me is how we tell the story, right? How we teach this, how we pass this on to future generations. And I'm wondering for you, as someone who is kind of the lead of this exhibit, what's the takeaway from this project for you? What do you want us to come away with?
That's a great question. I asked all of the, we had a kind of rollout event yesterday, and I asked everyone to speak to that, all the students, the grad students, undergrads, staff who worked on this. One of my takeaways is what you started out with, that Illinois in this period is not simply the land of Lincoln. It was not only a white state. When we think of the early Midwest, we need to think of diversity, both the idea that Black people were here and also the presence, the continuing presence of Native Americans, even after the period when we're taught that they were removed or they weren't here, people still were here. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one thing, is just sort of disrupting our idea of what the history of the state looks like, bringing the Black laws back in, bringing this component of race and kind of questions of race back in. But then I also have to say, I mean, the profiles that we wrote became very near to my heart. I just loved kind of seeing the unfolding of these stories insofar as we were able to tell them, including, you know, of women. I mentioned Anna Hudlin. I mean, there's a woman, there's Satira Douglas, who was known as the wife of a more prominent activist named H. Ford Douglas. But Satira Douglas lived this incredibly interesting life before she married and after her first husband died. So she had gone to Oberlin for at least a year in the 1850s. She was part of a Black women's organization during the Civil War that raised money to help people escaping from slavery and to support Black soldiers. After her first husband died, she moved to Indianapolis and became a teacher for a very long time. And then we even found evidence that by the end of the 19th century, she was giving lectures on the topic of women's involvement in the abolitionist movement. So she's just this tremendous person. And, yeah. You know, I was so taken with the kind of opportunity to tell these stories and sort of think about the lives of people and all of the sort of amazing things that they did.
Well, this project is fascinating and everyone should check it out. It's called Black Organizing in Pre-Civil War Illinois, Creating Community, Demanding Justice. And Kate Mazur is the project director for this exhibit. It's online. We will link up to it on all of our channels. And Kate Mazur is a professor of history at Northwestern University. Kate, congratulations to you and your team for this wonderful project. I plan on diving further into it, and we all should. It's an important story. And keep up the great work.
Thanks so much, Mike. It's great to be on the show.
Occasionally, Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Oh yes, once again, connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of one Mr. Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in the Chicago Reader. And we are definitely in the winter blues because it was frigid at times this week. And as we are in the winter blues here in The Secret History of Chicago Music, we're listening to the sweet sounds of J.T. Brown. J.T. Brown, Steve, he's all over that sax, isn't he?
Yes. Not necessarily, you know, as I mentioned in my intro, the first instrument people think of with the blues as we, you know, delve deeper into blues musicians from Chicago. But it can play a pivotal role. You know, you think of your harmonicas, you think of your electric guitars, but the sax can be pretty important to the blues.
That's right. And the way that he plays it, too. I mean, J.T. Brown, he has a great sound. And again, here's an example of a guy playing with the greats. I mean, he's really played with some amazing blues musicians throughout his life. He's seen it all.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and of several generations, too. You know, he's another guy who sort of went across generations. I mean, he started off in, you know, this sort of problematic, shall we say, minstrel shows early on, though some were owned by black performers who were in them. I found out doing a little research into that. Still, you know, whatever. But yeah, so you know, he was performing, you know, way back, and then he also played with some of the greats of the electric, you know, blues era, like, you know, Howlin' Wolf and Elmore James too. So, you know, he was raw enough for the best guys and sort of polished enough for everyone, you know.
Yeah, well, let's talk about his story. So he's born in Mississippi, 1918. So this is a little bit on the earlier side here in terms of people that we've been talking about recently here on the show. But it's, as you write here, it's hard because a lot of his early life, we just don't know about. It's very obscure, but we have kind of bits and pieces of his early life.
Yeah, he's one of those, you know, like I've often said, blues historians are pretty meticulous in their documentation. A lot of times with the pre-war kind of blues guys, even more so, they're like looking up census records and stuff like that. But yeah, not a ton on his early days of old J.T. Brown. I mean, all they really know is that he sort of, you know, after he was in this thing called the Rabbit's Foot Minstrels, he came to Chicago in the mid-40s, you know, so we're talking a ways back for sure.
So he's not coming here to Chicago, as you say, until the 1940s. But you mentioned this before. So he was part of this Rabbit's Foot Minstrels. And if you've taken U.S. history at any point in your life, you know, and you said that before, this is a little bit problematic. I mean, we have a lot of racial undertones and maybe not even that. I mean, it's explicitly racist, although that was looked at as entertainment during parts of the 20th century. But he was definitely a part of that. And the other side to this is that, well, all right, he's playing a lot and he's developing his craft.
Well, yeah. And funny enough, you know, this particular show was this group, Rabbit's Foot Minstrels, which, you know, like I said, did grow out of a thing owned by a black man. There was amazing people in it, as well as him, because, you know, they were sort of like, you know, I guess at their best, you know, a little bit like they had comedy, they had all sorts of different things, you know, sort of different performances or whatever. But Rufus Thomas, Lewis Jordan, all, you know, Ma Rainey were all part of this thing. So, you know, it was a way to get started sort of in the entertainment business, you know, sort of like vaudeville, I guess, you know, in a way would be the closest compare, you know, a more racist vaudeville. But vaudeville sounds like it had its own problems, too. They had strippers and, you know, body entertainment galore. It wasn't right. for the classy people to go to, you know.
That's right. Well, let's talk about his time in Chicago, because this is where he's really flourishing here. He starts to play with everyone, and he's playing all over the city on saxophone. JT Brown, tell us about his time here in Chicago.
Well, yeah, he, you know, I guess he was known, this guitarist, Jody Williams, who actually played with Bo Diddley for a bit, said he could make his horn sound like a nanny goat. I don't know exactly what that means, but he was playing all over the place with his nanny goat sound. He had all these aliases: Saxman Brown, JT Big Boy Brown, Bep Brown, Nature Boy Brown, JT Blow It Brown. And yeah, he starts recording these sort of 78s. You know, but by the end of the 40s, and, you know, sort of playing with more that earlier generation, I said, you know, of blues musicians, Washboard Sam. You know, obviously the Washboard was gone by the 50s and 60s, you know, so like he sort of went across barriers a little bit there.
All right, in 1969, JT Brown, he's playing with Fleetwood Mac, right? I mean, members of Fleetwood Mac, not the Lindsey Buckingham, Stevie Nicks version, but there was a version before that, and maybe we don't know. I think a lot of us do, but maybe some don't. The kids.
Well, there were several versions really before that, yeah. Is what people don't even really know. But maybe Fleetwood Mac consciousness is rising as the band's profile remains high. In general, like, those records have all been like reissued, including, you know, there was a period where Bob Welch and some of these other people were in also before Stevie and Lindsey came in later, before the LA years, if you will.
Right.
You know, they were a British band, and sure enough, the Brits love the blues. And the early days of the band featured Peter Green, who I believe B.B. King said is his favorite guitar player. So that is pretty serious stuff right there. Danny Kirwan on second guitar, possibly two of the best white boys to ever play the blues. Yeah. Not, you know, people want to give it to Eric Clapton, people want to give it to some of these other people, but yes, the early version of Fleetwood Mac was very much an electric blues band, and very different, and very successful, actually. The thing, successful enough that they recorded a double album with them cherry-picking the best of Chicago session people to back them up and record in Chicago, which came out as four different LPs.
That's amazing.
That's actually how this all started. Me and my drummer, who's a blues aficionado, we were kind of talking about that, you know, Fleetwood Mac, and it's a double LP, is I believe the original release of Fleetwood Mac in Chicago, and it kind of looks like it would be a live album that even kind of mimic the Chicago, the band logo a little bit. And, you know, I don't know if that was on purpose or what, but the addition I have of it, and then I'm, you know, looking at all the names of people who play on it, and yeah, it's like Buddy Guy, you know, all these sort of classic people are playing on it. And then I'm like, who are some of these other people, you know, who's JT Brown, you know, who are some of these guys? And Honey Boy Edwards is on it as well, who sort of found fame maybe a little bit later in his life of, you know, being a sort of important blues man and stuff. So that's actually what sort of led to it. But yeah, there's, you know, four release, and, you know, as a sort of testament to his, he's singing numbers on it. You know, guys from Fleetwood Mac are like, we don't need to sing this, you sing it, you know, because, wow. You know, but yeah, that's, you know, a lot of rock crossover there, people might know him from that.
That's right. So he's playing, JT Brown is on that double album from the early version of Fleetwood Mac. That's 1969. Now, unfortunately, that same year, 1969, JT Brown, this great sax player, he dies at age 51, way too early, because of a failed lung surgery at Michael Reese Hospital in Bronzeville. So really, he dies, I mean, way before his time. And that's unfortunate. And then, of course, we've seen this before, his burial, I mean, no proper headstone.
It's just shameful, you know, just to read about this. Here, one minute he's on these releases that probably made the label some money, you know, with playing with Fleetwood Mac. And then, yeah, the timing is really sad because the whole blues revival was going on. He could have, he was only 51. Yeah. You know, he, you know, I'm 49. that's not good to think about, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, you know, so it's a shame. And then, yeah, you see that, you know, here's a guy who sort of played with all the greats and he doesn't get a tombstone. But there is this really great organization. I've read about it in multiple strips I've covered on Blues Guys, called Killer Blues. And they pretty much have these festivals in Whitehall, Michigan, to raise money to get a proper headstone and stuff for some of these blues artists. And they did just that in 2011.
Wow. Well, so that's great. I mean, it should be. I mean, come on. He's done so much. JT Brown, he passed before his time, I think. And it's good that he got some love there and a proper headstone. He's buried in Burr Oak Cemetery in Worth, Illinois. And we can check out the full story of sax man JT Brown. Spent lots of his time here in Chicago. We can go to chicagoreader.com or pick up a hard copy of the Chicago Reader for The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip. It is authored by Steve Krakow, also known as Plastic Crime Wave. He hand draws whoever he's profiling in the Reader and on the website, so check that out. Hey, Steve, thanks so much as always, man. Great story here. Great musician with JT Brown and Nanny Goat. I like it.
You know, and I was going to say, you can still check him out. There are compilations galore. The man's endures, you know. They started compiling his work as early as the 70s. And up to 2005, you can buy releases that compile his work. So check out the man, JT Brown.
Got in a blackjack game last night. I lost every dime I had. Got in a blackjack game last night.
And that will do it. Outside the Loop show number 851 is done. Thank you, as always, for listening to the show this week. I appreciate you. I also appreciate Bob Ferguson, who is our engineer. Thank you, Fergie. Have a fantastic week. Stay warm. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.